Today is July 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, yet another terrorist attack in Bangladesh.
Well, the term I like to use to describe the state of affairs in Bangladesh now is powder keg, a really volatile situation that could well explode.
Also ahead, two shootings of African-American men by police in the United States have been the focus of social media. We'll discuss that with their social media guru, Andrew Palchesky. And we check in with VOA's Luis Ramirez. He's in Warsaw for the NATO gathering set to begin on Friday. It's all on today's International Edition. On VOA's International Edition, there has been another terrorist attack in Bangladesh. This latest occurred Thursday during Eid celebrations when five suspected Islamists armed with crude bombs and machetes attacked a security post near a mosque that hosts the largest congregation in the country. Two police officers and a woman were killed. At least nine others were injured in the attack in Kishorganj district, about 440 kilometers from Dhaka. One militant was killed, three were arrested. The strike comes just days after Bangladesh's worst ever terror attack, in which gunmen killed 20 people they took hostage in a bakery in Dhaka. After today's attack, the country's information minister says the government is not now ruling out the possibility of a link between homegrown militant groups and transnational terror outfits. Hassanul Haq Inu told VOA that it was too early to say who was responsible for the latest attack. His quote is this: "As far as our information goes, as far as our interrogation with arrested terrorists, there is no such organizational evidence of Bangladeshi terrorists and the IS. That is our position, but we are looking into the option of a link between IS, Pakistan, Jamaat-e Islami of Bangladesh." We welcome to International Edition Michael Kugelman, a senior associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Michael, welcome. Is that somewhat surprising to you, that what Inu has said?
Yes, it's quite surprising, because to this point, the Bangladesh government has stridently denied any possibility that Islamic State, or Al-Qaeda for that matter, could have links to local terror groups in Bangladesh, or that transnational terror groups like Islamic State or Al-Qaeda could have been responsible for staging any of these recent attacks, including the one in Dhaka on Friday. So the fact that a top government official in Bangladesh has said that we cannot rule out that possibility is certainly a step in the right direction, and indeed quite striking, because we have not heard such messaging or comments before this.
Earlier today, the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, came out with a statement saying that there is no room whatsoever for anyone across the world, any government whatsoever, that's being lenient on terrorists. That seemed to be leaning that way as well, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the messaging that comes out of the government in Bangladesh on terrorism and counterterrorism is very odd, quite frankly. It's very confusing. It's very contradictory, in the sense that this government is indeed, it has very strong counterterrorism bona fides. It has consistently condemned terrorist attacks. It staged a number of attacks against individuals that it describes as terrorist suspects. But at the same time, you have this almost contradictory tendency of the government to also downplay the possible involvement of outside transnational terror groups in the terrorist acts in the country. So we have to take with a grain of salt some of these things that come out of the government, including what the Prime Minister has said.
What is happening in Bangladesh?
Yeah, well, the term I like to use to describe the state of affairs in Bangladesh now is powder keg, a really volatile situation that could well explode, in the sense that you could have more terror attacks like the ones you've had over the last few months. I mean, a combination of factors. One is that the society in Bangladesh does not suffer extensive levels of radicalization as Pakistan's does, for example. However, there are institutions, individuals in the country that support violent extremism, and they embrace and articulate the ideologies of extremism that drive terror. So you do have some, you know, religious schools, for example. You have certain clerics that are very hardline Islamist and would not necessarily rule out support for terrorism. So you do have that climate. But on the other hand, you have a very fraught political environment in which the government has consistently taken draconian policies against the political opposition in Bangladesh, which includes the political party Jamaat Islami, which is a conservative Islamist, pretty hard-line group. It's not a terror group, but there are pockets of support in this group for pretty hard-line, nasty-type extremist positions. And so the more you have the government in Bangladesh crack down against the likes of the Jamaat Islami, the more the possibility you could have of radicalization. If you have people that already have hardline views, if they see them and their supporters getting targeted, arrested, not in a position to channel grievances peacefully, that could contribute to an environment that could lead to radicalization, extremism, and terrorism.
Is there any way out? Do you see any way out of this hole they've dug?
Well, I mean, the first step is simple, and that's that the government in Bangladesh needs to actually acknowledge and own the terrorism problem in the country, and that should involve acknowledging that, you know, this could be a country that is now in the crosshairs of the likes of Islamic State, which I think it is. Only when you do that and you acknowledge that anything is possible can you be in a position to take credible, actionable, robust measures to deal with the problem. And I think a first step needs to be to probe possible links between local terror groups in Bangladesh and outside ones, because you know, some of the attack in Dhaka on July 1st, it was of such a scale and sophistication that I don't think it could have been done without support from outside groups. These local groups are deadly; they do terrible things, but I don't think they're capable of causing as much loss of life as they are if they have help from outside groups. So the government needs to acknowledge the possibility of collusion between the local groups and the outside groups and take things from there.
Michael Kugelman is Senior Associate for South and Southeast Asia for the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. Michael, as always, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, Bangladesh Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina has pleaded with families across Bangladesh to report to police if any of their sons have gone missing in recent months, as the hostage takers had before staging their restaurant attack in Dhaka's diplomatic quarter last week. Many Bangladeshis have said they are horrified by the violence. We move from Bangladesh to the streets of two United States cities. Man was fatally shot Wednesday night by a police officer during a traffic stop in the Midwestern city of Falcon Heights, Minnesota. It was the second fatal police shooting of an African-American man by white police officers in as many days. In the latest shooting, a child and a woman were passengers in the car. Shortly after the shots were fired, the woman began video recording the scene on her cell phone and then streamed it live on her private Facebook account. Victim was shown slumped in the car and bleeding profusely, with at least one officer pointing a gun through the driver's side window. Police say the incident began when a policeman pulled over the vehicle. Police have not disclosed the reason for the traffic stop or confirmed that the video is of the same incident. The victim's been identified as a 32-year-old man from St. Paul, Minnesota. He was a cafeteria supervisor at a Montessori school. Now, the shooting comes a day after police killed a 37-year-old man in the southern city of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Officers responded to a call there about an armed man pinned the victim to the ground when at least one officer shot him. The investigation into the shooting is led by the U.S. Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division. Both shootings are raising questions about excessive police force, particularly used against minorities. And both of them, Andrew Palshevsky, International Edition's social media guru, were caught on social media. And we began our discussion yesterday on this about the sea change that social media has made to incidents like this and the entire whole scope of how the public reacts.
Yeah, we talked about the case of Alton Sterling yesterday in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and that shooting captured on cell phone video uploaded to social media. And in the past this has happened, we saw Walter Scott in South Carolina similarly was shot, and that was captured on cell phone video uploaded to social media. Well, now we have this case of Philando Castile in Minnesota, where it's not just cell phone video, it's Facebook Live. His girlfriend actually films it on Facebook Live as he's lying there bleeding. And so this marks kind of a new step in how social media is playing a role in these cases. It's not just that these videos are getting uploaded afterwards, it's that they're going out live as they happen. And it's kind of two different elements to this. One, we were mentioning this morning in our morning editorial meeting, is that police are going to use this as evidence and potentially in the case to review what happened. But the other way it's being used is, as this video goes out, I've seen it shared and reposted by countless people on Facebook, on Twitter, on other social media.
All over the world.
All over the world. You go on social media and Philando Castile is the top trending hashtag in the U.S. and you click on that and just about every single post is some version of that video. So just the way that it spreads so quickly and to be able to see this, it's one thing to read about a shooting like this, but to be able to see it and to see him there bleeding and to see his girlfriend kind of giving commentary as this is happening. And then we see after the fact, his girlfriend actually released another Facebook Live video today where she's commenting on the shooting and she breaks down and she's talking about what went on. So it's not just cataloging and capturing these horrible shootings. It's also used as a tool afterwards to kind of speak out. And we're actually seeing, as I'm looking through, people organizing marches and vigils throughout the country using social media as a way to organize those groups. So it's being used in that regard as well. Sadly, I think we're going to see this evolution of social media as these two cases play out, as these protests gather, as people express their outrage. We're going to continue to see social media play a role.
Well, in the role of social media, if you have something to say about this, and we sure you do, people should get in touch with Andrew. And how do they do that?
They can find me on Twitter at APAL, APAL, and they can also find International Edition at VOA underscore IE.
Thanks, Andrew. This is VOA, and this is International Edition. Among the top stories we're covering for you, the Bangladesh Information Minister says the government is not ruling out the possibility of a link between homegrown militant groups and transnational terror outfits. The shooting death of two African-American men by police officers in as many days in the United States is leading to intense reaction. The chief of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation defends his decision to not pursue a criminal case against Hillary Clinton for handling of classified national security information while she was Secretary of State. And for the first time, the United States has put North Korea's leader on the U.S. sanctions list for human rights abuses. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A couple of weeks ago, we told you about the discovery of Kepler-1647b, the biggest planet to circle a twin star system that has been found so far. Now, a team of astronomers has captured a direct image of the first planet ever found in a wide orbit inside a triple star system. They made their discovery by using the so-called Sphere instrument on the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in the Atacama Desert of northern Chile. The astronomers say the exoplanet, located about 320 light-years from Earth in the constellation of Centaurus, is a very young 16 million years old and is one of very few exoplanets that have been directly imaged. If it were possible to visit this planet, you would experience either constant daylight or triple sunrises and sunsets each day, depending on the seasons, which can last longer than human lifetimes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
On the heels of a U.S. announcement to keep 8,400 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, NATO leaders will meet in Warsaw Friday and Saturday to discuss three key security topics: continuing support for Afghan forces, defeating Islamic State militants on NATO's southern flank, and deterring Russian aggression on the alliance's eastern flank. We welcome to International Edition VOA's chief European correspondent, Luis Ramirez, who joins us from Warsaw. Luis, out of that list I just read, what are the chief priorities, the top priorities of the summit?
Well, Ira, it's not on the official agenda, but I can tell you that at the top of everyone's list here is going to be the issue of Brexit, Britain's decision to leave the European Union. Britain is the other heavy hitter in the alliance, and so it's a cause for concern. There are many questions that are going to be posed here to British Prime Minister David Cameron on what Britain's role will continue to be in the alliance. Now, of course, NATO and the EU are two separate entities, but it still represents a headache for President Obama and other members of NATO. The big issue officially on the agenda is Russia. Now, some people are calling this the most critical NATO meeting since the end of the Cold War. In fact, the U.S. ambassador to NATO on Wednesday said this summit comes at a real demarcation point, as he said, or an inflection point in the history of this alliance. Russia is building up its nuclear arsenal, and there are concerns about whether it will move to attack the Baltic states of Latvia and Estonia. Russia doing this because it's nervous about nations that were once part of its empire moving closer to the EU. And that's the essence of Russia's intervention in Ukraine, which is showing no signs of slowing down.
You know, it's interesting that this meeting, this NATO meeting, is being hosted by Poland. And you think of Poland, if you're, you know, anything over the age of 25 like you and I are, it's a longtime Russian ally, and you somehow compare the two and put the two together. Has there been any talk of that?
Well, you know, it really certainly is ironic that NATO was created to deal with the Soviet threat, and the rival alliance was the Warsaw Pact, with communist countries aligned with the Soviet Union. So many of those countries are now here as members of NATO. It's a great irony, but it shows how far the world has come in less than 30 years. That said, because of the threat of Russia and what Russia perceives as a number of these buffer states that it had maintained through several decades, as I said, a buffer zone, the fact that many of these countries have come over to the NATO side, a great source of anxiety for the Russians, and so that's going to be a big topic, certainly hanging over the heads of leaders meeting here.
How many leaders are coming, and who do they include? You already mentioned Cameron.
Sure. The heads of state of the 28 member states. So, of course, President Obama is going to be here. And in addition, you're going to have leaders of non-member states. Most notable of them is Petro Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine. He's here in a lobbying role. His interests are very much at stake here, since much of the discussion will focus on Ukraine and Russia's refusal to end its intervention in eastern Ukraine and its takeover of the Crimea. That situation, we don't hear about it much in the news these days, but it is not going away. We haven't seen the summer offensive that many people were predicting, but certainly at the same time, there is no sign that Russia is pulling back. So President Poroshenko will lobby President Obama and other NATO leaders to do more than offer non-lethal assistance. That is not likely.
VOA's chief European correspondent, Luis Ramirez from Warsaw, joining us on International Edition. Thanks, Luis. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at The Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings. Every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on The Voice of America.
From The Voice of America, this is International Edition. The chief of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation is defending his decision to not pursue a criminal case against Hillary Clinton for her handling of classified national security information while she was Secretary of State, even though he said that investigators found great carelessness in her use of private, unsecured email servers. The FBI Director James Comey told a House of Representatives panel that after a year-long probe, investigators decided there was no evidence that either Clinton, now the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, or her aides, intended to break U.S. laws against the disclosure of classified materials. The investigators found 113 classified documents in the more than 30,000 Clinton emails they reviewed from her 2009-2013 tenure as the country's top diplomat. Comey also said that it would have been inappropriate to charge Clinton seeking to become the first U.S. female president under a 1917 U.S. law making gross negligence a crime. He said the law had only been used once to bring charges in an espionage case and that the Department of Justice prosecutors have grave concerns whether it is appropriate to prosecute someone for gross negligence. Comey's testimony came 2 days after announcing that investigators had concluded no criminal case should be brought against Clinton, a recommendation Attorney General Loretta Lynch accepted Wednesday, ending the case without any charges against Clinton. Clinton has yet to comment on the FBI's findings that she and her colleagues were extremely careless in the handling of the classified material. Answered questions from FBI investigators for 3.5 hours last Saturday, Comey said there was no basis to conclude that she lied to the FBI. Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz, the panel's chairman, said he was mystified and confused how the FBI can find that Clinton mishandled dozens of classified documents and then not be criminally charged. Chaffetz said, if your name is not Clinton or you're not part of the powerful elite, then Lady Justice will act differently. Hillary Clinton created this mess. Now, as you can probably tell, this has caused a political firestorm. It's in the midst of a highly charged national presidential campaign with Clinton set to face off with presumptive Republican nominee, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump in the November national election to pick the successor to President Barack Obama, who leaves office in January. And Secretary of State John Kerry says North Korean officials at all levels need to know there are consequences for their actions after the U.S. blacklisted top figures for human rights abuses. Treasury Department imposed sanctions Wednesday on North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and 10 other senior officials. Now, that's going to wrap things up for us. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us. Director Steve Karish, engineer Nick Ivanoff. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, the world is witness to the greatest refugee crisis since the end of the Second World War, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Samantha Power. And because it is global in scale, anything less than a global response will fall short of addressing it, she said.
Yet rather than spur a united front, a united effort, the challenge of mass displacement has divided the international community and even individual nations, leaving the lion's share of the response to a small number of countries, stretching our humanitarian system to its breaking point and putting millions of people in dire situations at even greater risk.
Obviously, the best way to resolve the crisis is to address the conflict, violence, and repression that is forcing people out of their homes. But in the meantime, we must do more to help, not only for their sake, but for our own security and stability. First, we must meet the vital needs of refugees in the present. Here we are coming up far short, said Ambassador Power. We are seeing record shortfalls in providing essential humanitarian assistance. In 2015, the UN requested approximately $20 billion to provide life-saving aid, only $11 billion of which was funded. This year, the $21 billion that the UN is seeking is less than one quarter funded. And second, we must offer refugee or resettlement to the displaced. By relying on a few countries to bear a disproportionate share of the cost of the crisis, the lives of many refugees are put at risk and may fall prey to violent extremists and members of organized crime. In recognition of the urgent need for all countries to do more, President Obama is convening on September 20th the Leaders' Summit on Refugees on the margins of the 71st UN General Assembly. In addition, the United States is also taking steps to increase our humanitarian aid to refugees and increasing the number of refugees we will resettle in the United States. We call on our friends and partners to follow our lead for the sake of the displaced and the global community.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.